down by the water.
Welcome back to season 2 of the Run Culture Podcast. My name is Dane Verway. I'm an experienced running physiotherapist, coach, and marathoner. This season will involve open discussions with my running colleagues about the key principles behind injury-free running and optimal performance. It'll be backed by personal experience, science, and history. I can only hope some of these chats inspire curiosity and expand or confirm perspectives and beliefs amongst the running community. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Run Culture Podcast. Today I'm very lucky to have Callum Jones on the show. I first came across Callum only recently when I was trying to find out more about the Norwegian double threshold method and came across him and Gavin's fantastic podcast called Conversations About Running. Callum is a competitive runner over 1510K himself, and also a coach at Train Smarter, Run Faster with famed Kenyan coach Hugo Vandenbroek, who he has studied extensively under. He's also a head of marketing and coach at Running Trips, a company that does training camps in Kenya. He has a girlfriend from Norway, so has spent a considerable amount of time in Norway trialing the double threshold method. He lives in Cornwall, runs for Bristol Track Club. Welcome to the podcast, Callum.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a pretty good summary, I would say.
Yeah, how far off was I?
Yeah, no, it was pretty accurate. Yeah, nice. Okay. Sounds a little bit strange having someone like read your kind of like your bio back to you. I'm like, oh man, yeah, I actually wrote all those things. Crazy.
Yeah, the internet's an amazing thing. thanks for popping on the show. And I thought, like I just briefed you before, like it'd be great to have you on the show because of your experiences as a runner, a coach, just down here in Australia, we've got sort of a typical way where a lot of people train. So it's great to have different experiences and different personal takes to hear from. So I guess where I wanted to start was just maybe a little bit more about you and maybe in your own words, like how did you get started into running and perhaps like how did you get started with your experiences in Kenya and with running trips and how did that all evolve with Hugo and a bit more about your own running journey?
Yeah, sure. See, I've been running like literally for as long as I can remember, really, to be honest, since school. Cross country is like quite big in schools over here in the UK, like especially primary school. It's like a thing that a lot of kids do at primary school I'm not going to say you're forced to do it, but it's like you do it in PE, you know, all the kids go and do a cross country run in PE, and the kids who are like kind of good at it are like celebrated, and then you go and do the like inter-schools championships and then the like the county schools championships and stuff like that, and there's quite a good structure of progression as in cross country at a school level. So I did that in primary school, like age of, I don't know what's primary school age, like 9-10 years old. Kind of too young to be like seriously training unless you're Jakob Ingebrigtsen, but you know, I was like running for fun, playing football and just pretty fit for a kid. And then, yeah, started doing pretty well, I guess, year 7, year 8, year 9, and just continued taking it kind of seriously, really. I would say I've never really, like, you know, I've never gone on to any, like, greater heights than running at a somewhat national level. As when I say national level, you know, I'm like, I try to go to, like, British indoor championships and stuff like that. And, but I'm not winning national championships or anything by any stretch of the imagination, but kept it at like a pretty serious level my whole life, really, to be honest with you. And then, yeah, so when while I was at university, I was still training, still running on, with a group there. And to move on to your like Kenya question, we basically decided that it was a place we wanted to go. It was just a cool place that we'd heard a lot about, you know, this kind of semi-mythical village in Kenya where all the elites live and train. And, you know, you hear about people running world records from there. And I think when I was at uni, or maybe a bit before that, David Rudisha was the big dog, you know, in the world. And that's where he trained under Brother Colm. So that kind of sparked my imagination a little bit. And yeah, we literally just, me and a group of friends decided to go out there and just have our own training camp and do our own thing. We went out there for 3 months, was our first trip. So a pretty extended trip out there. And yeah, it was amazing. Like, absolutely loved it. It was humbling for sure. you know, like, again, like talking about my own standard of running, I'm nothing special, but just to give you a flavor, I ran 3:46 in the 1500, 29:48 in the 10K, and 14:05 in the 5K. Yeah, like we did do, I did two races while I was out there, two cross country races, one in El Dorret and one in, I know they're both in El Dorret, actually, just not far from E10 where we were staying. And just got, yeah, absolutely rinsed, like absolutely destroyed. I was with one of my friends who's also a good runner. And we were joking about beforehand, like, oh yeah, we're probably gonna come last, like, you know, taking the mickey out of ourselves. And he actually did come last, like he was dead last in the field. There were 109 people finished and he was 109th and I was 100th in that race. So yeah, humbling. Although, we also noticed that a lot of people just dropped out when we overtook them. Like, I think they were like, oh, the white guys have overtaken us. So like, they just dropped out. They saw that as a failure and they were like, no, stepping off the course. But I think about 150 people started. And as we were kind of like picking them off, they were just dropping out. So maybe it's harsh to say we actually came last, but yeah, it was, we were near the back anyway. But yeah, that's how I got to, go out there in the first place, just decided to go, basically. That's also how I met my now coach, Hugo, because he had a guest house out there and we were just looking for places to stay and just coincidence happened to stay with him. And yeah, just got chatting with him while I was out there and he was a good coach. I liked his style. I liked him as a person. And yeah, I think it was a couple of years later that I asked him to coach me. And he's been coaching me now for, well, yeah, since then. So coming up for 7 years, actually.
Oh, wow.
Long time. Yeah. Maybe the six years. I first went out to Kenya in 2017 and I asked him to coach me a year later. So 6 years. And then what else did you ask? Running trips. Gavin, the founder of Running Trips, he's been the founder of Running Trips since 2010 is when they started. So yeah, it's been doing it for 14 years now. And just for anyone listening, Running Trips is essentially a company that organizes training camps for runners. One of the places, the main place I would say we organize our camps is in Kenya, in E10. And Gavin happened to be out there with a group of runners from Running Trips. He was out there on his own camp at the time that I was out there just on my own. Actually, no, that's a lie. I told it slightly wrong. He wasn't out there at the time, but there was a group out there. And he got in touch with us saying, hey, I can see you're out in Kenya, out in E10. That's where our camps are. And I've seen that you guys have got a drone and you're like taking some cool videos and stuff. Would you be able to like grab a few shots for me that I can, you know, like post on Instagram and stuff like that, and, you know, happy to tag you or whatever, blah blah blah. And you know, I was fresh out of uni and I was just like, right, you know what, this is a cool opportunity. I basically worded an email back to him as if I was like, professional videographer, like worded it really well. I was like, properly, like, I was like, dear Gavin, like, yes, we can do this for you, but like, here's the layout, this is what it will be, this is the cost, and this, not just like, yeah, sure, mate, I'll fire some videos over for you, no worries. I was like, right, this is going to be a professional ordeal.
Yeah.
And looking back now, like, we both laugh about it, because I'm by no means like, I just had a drone and I was flying it around for fun. So we did that, and then he came out to attend a couple of weeks later, and we met in person, and yeah, we just got on pretty well, really, to be honest. He told me about the camps he was organizing, what it was, what he was doing, and I really liked it, and basically just kind of naturally flowed into me helping him with a little bit more work. Over the course of the year, I was just doing like social media stuff, bits and pieces, now, yeah, I'm somewhat full-time, still part-time, I guess, but like, because I also work for On, the sportswear brand, running brand.
Uh-huh.
That's like my, I would say, full-time job, and then running trips I'm also doing, but like quite heavily invested in it, and yeah, we both work pretty hard to try and make it what it is. That's the story behind that one.
Oh, that's great. And so when you went to Kenya, how did your running actually go after that? Like, did you improve after that experience, and how did it change? Like, what did you learn from training with the Kenyans that still has left a lasting impression now and today?
Good question. It did change a lot. I PB'd and everything when I came back. My 5K PB took a massive chunk off. I think my personal best before I went out in the 5K was 15:20, something like that, 15:20.
Yeah.
And then I ran 14:49 in my first race back. Oh, wow. And then 14:30 in the following summer on the track. So that was probably the biggest chunk I've ever taken off my 5K PB, yeah. even did, you know. But yeah, we were there for 3 months, so like a pretty big period of high altitude training. And I would say like I went hard on the training, as in, yeah, like not intensity wise, but like I was very dedicated. I was sometimes doing actually triple, like three runs per day, like first thing in the morning, once in the afternoon, and then once again in the evening. I wouldn't, looking back now and from what I know now, I wouldn't repeat that, but that's just, I think I read something about David Rudisha doing that, and I was like, I'm gonna do that then. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I just read it in a magazine or something, and I was like, yeah, that's what I'm gonna do. Yeah, but the way the Kenyans train and the Kenyan running culture is very different to other places I've trained, and especially like here in the UK and Norway, which you mentioned earlier, it is really different. And I guess we will go into like the Norwegian method a little bit later on, but it's, yep, in Kenya, it's quite polarized, the training. Like, it's very, their easy days are very easy, and their hard days are hard. They do have like moderate in between days as well. You know, some of their easy runs, they kind of pick up towards the end and finish at like a moderate effort, moderate pace. But I would say in general, it's easy days are easy and hard days are hard.
Uh-huh.
Which is actually almost the opposite of what I'm doing now with the Norwegian kind of training.
Yeah.
I don't think one is right and one is wrong. I just think that's, well, obviously, like, you know, some of the Kenyans are still among the, probably are the best runners in the world, right, as a nation.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just how I noticed that they train. And yeah, like the there's this phrase, the Kenyan shuffle, which is real. You know, they go out and do their easy runs like proper, like painfully slow sometimes. Like it's hard as a half decent runner, it's hard to run that slow.
Yes.
You know, they're running 10 minute miling, maybe even slower, and you're like, really, it's you're like struggling not to walk, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
On their easy days, but then on other easy days, you know, they're doing they'll start at that pace, and by the end they're going at 3:10, 3:20 per k, and you can barely keep up. and they're calling that. Yeah, it's easy. We just go a little bit harder at the end, and I'm like, yeah, okay. But yeah, as a general culture sense, like there's a lot more. There are very few people, at least in E10, maybe in the bigger cities, maybe like Nairobi, this is different, but in E10, very, very few people run for fun, run for fitness or enjoyment. They're, everyone who runs, pretty much, runs because they believe they can achieve heights in running. They believe they can make some money or win races or go abroad. So that makes it, that makes the depth of field very high, you know, like
yep.
the top runners in Kenya. Well, there's a lot of good runners in Kenya, yeah. First. There's a lot of good runners in E10, but all of them are like, they believe they can be competitive on a world stage. Mm-hmm. And genuinely, you know, even if you go down to just the local fartlek run and you speak to the guys down there, there's, I don't know, 100 to 200 people at a training session. All of them think that they will be internationally competitive at some point.
Yeah.
So that's quite an interesting difference. Like they know they're not running for fun. They know that they want this to be their job. And I would also say that it's very like, how do I describe this? It's like their life revolves around that fact. So, you know, they're training, then they go home, they're eating, sleeping, resting, getting ready for training. And like, yeah, some of them do go on to make money and, you know, they'll make, you know, a decent wedge from winning a race. And those people will then kind of share that wealth with their wider training group to ensure the success of the wider group so that they can live like that. You know, they can go home, sleep, train, eat, repeat.
Uh-huh.
Not everyone, obviously, I'm kind of being somewhat yeah. general here. Some of them, yeah. you know, still work on the farm and then train in the evening, but in talking about like the actual training groups, the training compounds, training centers, the better guys or the better runners will share the wealth with the rest of them and try to encourage the whole team to be strong as one. So yeah, it's a very cool place. If anyone who's into running, I would definitely recommend visiting and training there. And that's why we set up, well, Gavin set up Running Trips essentially was, I guess before he set up Running Trips pre-2010, E10 was somewhere that elite runners went. And, you know, if you watched any videos on YouTube or anything, it was like, hey, this is where Mo Farah is going to train. This is where British Athletics have their high altitude training centers. And it's like, it's a cool place, but I'm never going to go there kind of thing. But Gavin set up Running Trips basically to make this place accessible to runners of all levels. So if anyone, you know, wants to just go out there for the experience, still train to the best of their ability, but also just take in the culture and see what it's about and meet the elite runners and watch them training and be guided by run guides and coaches and stuff while you're out there, then that's what it's for, essentially, is to allow anyone to go and experience what was previously only for elite runners. So yeah, it's pretty cool in my opinion.
No, I think it's a fantastic initiative, because a little bit about myself, I'm like you, like just loved the sport since I was really young and have tried to be as good a runner as I possibly could be the whole way through. And in 2014, I went to Kenya as well, but only for 7 weeks. And I stayed at Lorna Kiplagat's high altitude training center. And I just organized it myself. So it's nice to see that there's a company that you could potentially go with and make it a bit easier. Because I know when I went...
How long did you stay there for?
7 weeks. I stayed...
I'm surprised you don't know Gavin somewhat personally then. Because there would have been a very high chance of you two crossing over. Because his wife, Lauren...
Yeah.
She was the manager of the camp, of Lorna's camp, for quite a while. I think it was around 2010 sort of time. So a little bit before you went out. Gavin will probably correct me after this, but I'm surprised you two have not crossed paths at some point.
I think I did see a van or something Yeah, but I was just sort of, everything was new to me over there, and yeah, it was. And then yeah, when I was there, Mo Farah was in the room next to me. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. But yeah, I think what I got from it the most was just the different culture and how, yeah, like how happy and grateful so many Kenyans are, like, and how approachable they are. And yeah, it was amazing. Like, I'd walk into I-10 and I wouldn't know where I'm going, but then someone would go out their way and show me where to go. Yeah, so I really got a lot out of yeah, their way of being. And you know, one time we were stuck in a traffic jam because the roads were appalling there, for about 2 hours. And I just remember the two drivers of the Matatus just like, legs crossed on the dashboard, like hands behind their head and laughing, like, and for 2 hours. And they were just chatting and they were making the most of the time. Whereas I just couldn't see that happening here. Like, everyone would be stressed, looking at their watch, frustrated. Oh, I'm late for this, I'm late for that. And so it's just a completely
Exactly.
different
So
way.
one thing I often repeat to myself here when I'm at home is our like head tour guide, Willie Songkok, honestly one of the best people I know, just like such a great guy. But he always, whenever he introduces the camps to our guests who come over, one of the first things he said is, in Kenya there's no such thing as a problem, just unusual situations. So then, and then for the rest of the 2 weeks, anytime like someone's in a traffic jam or someone's late or I don't know, something goes wrong or whatever, everyone's saying, oh, it's not a problem, it's just an unusual situation. And yeah, I quite like that.
Now that's really nice way to phrase it. So yeah, from there, like, you didn't get injured when you're doing those three runs a day. Like, you're pretty lucky there, or
Yeah, I've always been. So firstly, when I say I was doing 3 runs a day, that was once per week. I was probably doing about 100 to 110 miles a week on average. So not crazy. The 3 runs per day thing was just something I kind of wanted to try because, like I said, I read an elite runner was doing it. But yeah, no, back to the injury question. I've always been pretty lucky, to be honest. Well, I say luck, but I did a lot of strength training as a kid. And I've looking back now, I kind of think that's the reason I don't get injured. And again, the strength training thing was just because I've always been a big fan of Seb Coe. And yeah, when I was a kid and getting into it and kind of, going to athletics clubs and stuff, I read that Seb Coe did loads of gym work and I was watching old YouTube videos and just like reading old magazine clips and stuff of him, little documentaries on Seb Coe and stuff. And there was always stuff about him doing strength training. So I was like, right, I'm going to do that. So then I probably had a period of close to like 3 or 4 years where every morning I was doing circuit training before school. Quite hard circuit training, with like squats, press ups, sit ups, burpees, almost like army type training. And again, looking back now, would I say that was the correct training if I wanted to be a good runner? Probably not. But I also basically never get injured, so I'm maybe that has something to do with it, and maybe I'm just kind of lucky because my mileage now is actually still quite high. Like, especially for someone with, I've got a full-time job and I do travel for work quite a bit, and I'm fairly like on my feet a lot of the time, and I run. Yeah, probably on average 100 miles a week, sometimes 110, and I yeah don't really get injured, so quite lucky in that respect.
Well, how old were you when you were doing the circuit training 3 mornings a week?
Pretty young, yeah. I was probably like my first years of school from the age of maybe like 12 to 15, 16, something like
Nice.
that. And then when that was because I was running once a day and circuit training once a day. So like I would run circuit training in the morning and then run in the afternoon. And then as I started adding more runs, so by the age of like 16, I was double daying like two runs per day, three times per week, and then I started like reducing the circuit training because it was unsustainable. But yeah, still, yeah, I do still believe that that had an impact on my injury resistance.
Yeah,
So,
I think there's something in that, for sure. Like, I'm a
yeah.
physio,
Okay.
as a my job, and the more and more like I read into it, like the more sort of broad like your foundation can be, through those developmental years. Like, you're developing like, to be like an athlete, like a lot of skills, and because running is just so repetitive and it is so one-dimensional, and it really wears you down, and I think you lose a lot of that athleticism, otherwise. So it's, I think there's definitely something in that.
And another thing, there are so many things, like, because I've been running for so long, there's so many things that I look back on and think, oh, I wouldn't have done that now, if you know what I mean. I wish I could go back and coach myself as a kid. But another thing that, like, talking about injury resistance and stuff like that, when I was, again, during those school years from age, 12 to 17-ish, something like that, I really had this mentality where any physical activity I did was benefiting my training. So at lunchtime, I used to play a lot of badminton and a lot of volleyball, just like PE at school, but more than PE. Like, I was going to like the after school clubs and training with a group outside of school, and competitions on the weekend and stuff like that. And I was like, running twice a day, and then also trying to do like badminton and volleyball, because I just believed that all of this stuff will benefit my running. Whereas now I obviously know that, hey, you want to like run, and then you need to recover from your running so that the next workout is optimal, and rinse and repeat, basically. But yeah, back at school, I was like, right, any workout I do is beneficial. So I was like just hammering everything. And I remember as well, I tell this story quite a bit, but I used to work for, in the summer holidays and like Christmas holidays and stuff at school, I used to work for a builder, just general builder, doing like house extensions and stuff like that, which by the way has been super handy now that I'm like, buying first houses and stuff. It's way better than any stuff I learned at school is the stuff I learned with this builder.
Handy
But anyway,
skills.
One summer in particular, you mentioned I live in Cornwall, and Cornwall, for anyone who doesn't know, is a really good surfing place, actually, for
Okay.
you Aussies. It's like super nice coastal region, lots of like cliffs and coastal area. And one of the houses we were building from scratch, actually, was on the cliff of a bay. So you look down on the beach, and my job all summer was all the building materials that got delivered for this house, the cement, the sand, the blocks, the wood, everything. There was no route up to the cliff. It had to be delivered to the bottom, and there was a public footpath that went to the top where the house was, and it was probably about 800 meters long. My job all summer was going up and down with a wheelbarrow, filling up the blocks and sand and everything one at a time, up and down, up and down. And like now, well, I wouldn't do that, because I'm like, I'm running, and I know that, hey, if I'm going to be doing that all day, there's no way I'm doing an interval session in the evening. But back then, I was literally like saying to the guys at the top, right, start your stopwatches, get ready to time me. I'm doing this next one in record time. And I was like running down with the wheelbarrow, filling it with sand, running back up. And I was like, right, coming like drenched in sweat. And I was like, yeah, this is such good training. But yeah, obviously that's not correct, but here I am.
It's a common mistake, like early days, where you think more is better, and you just try to pile it all into the week, and you forget about the rest and recovery, and that's just as important to it, to actually absorb it. I was just with back to sort of Hugo's influence on you, and the Kenyan influence on you. Like, what are some big principles that you think you've really learned from Hugo Vandenbroek, and his influence as your coach for the last 7 years?
The main reason I really like working with Hugo is that I think he really trusts my knowledge as well. So for me and him, it's not like he rarely tells me what to do, and we're just like, yeah, that's it, I'm gonna do that. It's more like, hey, what do you think? Like, oh, I think this, what about you? And it's a back and forth, and we come to an agreement, and like, this is what we're gonna do. It's a partnership, and
Nice.
we work out a plan and we go with it together. And I'll go back to him with a lot of suggestions, and then he'll come back to me, and then we come up with the final plan kind of thing. But like, yeah, he's very easy to trust as well, if you know what I mean. So like, when he does say something, when he says like, let's say I go back to him with a suggestion, and he comes back to me and says, no, I don't think you should do that, I think you should do this. I know that he's got his reasons for that, and I fully trust it. And for me, that's such an important like quality to have as a coach. You need to instill trust, right? If you don't trust your coach, then there's no point having them as a coach. They're just there for you to talk, someone to talk to, basically, right? Which is also important, but you need to trust that they're giving you the right training. And yeah, for us, that's something I definitely have with him. I fully trust that he's given me the not necessarily the right thing, because that's such a broad thing to say, but I trust that he's thought about what he's giving me, and that it's in my best interest to do it. In terms of principles, I wouldn't say there's anything like that you probably don't know. It's running is basic, in my opinion. It's if I had to highlight a couple of things that are maybe like, if I look at a program, I would know, right, Hugo's written that program, as opposed to someone else. If I had to highlight a few things, I would say, firstly, he comes from a specific marathon background. He was a good marathoner in his day. He ran 2:12. I think he went to the European champs. So he's a pretty big fan of volume, high volume training, and he's also a big fan of a meaty long run. Like, he likes to make some hard long run sessions. Yeah, I could, as a 1500 meter runner, when I first went to him, I was very much only a 1500 runner, barely touched 5K or 10K, and that's what I wanted to do. And even as a 1500 meter runner, he was putting some pretty like 17, 18 mile long runs with hard bits inside the long run, and I was like, whoa, this is this is tough for a 1500 guy. So that's, yeah, one thing I would say. But for the rest of it, I would say it's, yeah, he knows how to include recovery periods. He knows a lot about making sure you taper right for the races. Knowing when not to taper as well is another important aspect that I think he's very good at. Like, again, as a 1500 guy, I race quite a lot throughout the season, especially in the summer. Sometimes I'm racing multiple weeks in a row, so it's also important to know when to not taper so that you can maximize training. And yeah, he's good at that. And yeah, I wouldn't really know how to summarize his specific principles, because he's just good at being a coach.
Well, I think you like I really like what you said at the start, where he's good, a good listener, and good at sort of having a chat to you and getting and really listening to your ideas, because like you can really tell that you're a student of the sport. And whether it was your Sebco inspired kind of training, like initially, or like following David Rudisha's sort of exploits and going to Kenya, like, and then so is that like so, and then you've got your girlfriend in Norway. Like, when you sort of said, oh yeah, wouldn't mind trying some double threshold training, like how did that chat go? And I guess, like, how's your experiences gone when you sort of like, how did your performance go, firstly, like with the Kenyan kind of stuff? Like obviously, like you really improved initially, and then why did you sort of consider to switch it up a little bit in Norway? And how did that chat go?
After I initially started training the Norwegian way, and I guess so I'll elaborate on that a little bit in a minute, but after I did do that for about a year, that was probably my second biggest jump in performance following on from Kenya. So that was, yeah, I ran 14:05, my PB. That was actually 2 years ago now, because last year I ran 14:07. So got close, but not quite there. That was following pretty much a full year of training actually in Norway. So basically what happened is kind of by accident, but I've been with together with my girlfriend for coming up for 8 years, so quite a while. But only ever like visited Norway just for a week or less at a time. So I never really trained with anyone while I was out there. I just went out, did my own running, and then we came home and I was back with the guys here. But then we went out towards the end of the COVID pandemic. It was kind of when we thought it was like all over, like, oh, everything's returning to normal now. And we went out to stay with her family for Christmas. We went out like beginning of December and we planned to stay for like 3 weeks or something. And then while we were out there, everything just went crazy again. And everything back at home in the UK went full lockdown. Flights were cancelled. Everyone was told to stay at home. And our flight back to the UK was cancelled. So we had to delay it. And then the next flight was cancelled. So we delayed it. And then the next flight, it, three flights were cancelled in a row. So then we got to like mid-January and we were like, hey, you know what? Let's just stop trying. We'll stay here for a longer period. We'll stay here for a couple of months until everything's calmed down. And then we'll go back. So we ended up staying in Norway for about 6 months, actually. And that was when I actually said, like, oh, okay, you know what? I'm not just here for a week. I'm not just going to run on my own. So I reached out to a couple of people and started training with them. And I'd actually raced them a couple of times while I was in Norway. And okay, so another funny story I like to tell is one of my now a very good friend, Simon Hallerhaugen, who, we actually did a podcast with on our podcast. I messaged him. Oh, I'm gonna get the dates wrong, but I messaged him in like the summer of 2021, maybe 2022, something like that, saying, hey, like I'm in Norway for a week or so. Like, I was wondering if you wanted to do some running together. And I said, like, you know, I'm not quite as fast as you, but I can, we'll at least do some easy runs together or something. And he just completely ignored me and like completely blanked. It came up saying seen, message seen, but no reply. So I was like, yeah, all right, I see how it is. And then a couple of weeks later, we raced. So we were on the start line together at a race in Norway and I beat him. And then after I beat him, I messaged him back saying, oh, you sure you don't want to do some training together? And he replied saying like, yeah, let's go for a run. And yeah, so we've been very good friends since then. We've actually been on like multiple training camps together and stuff. Like we get on really well. So yeah, now every time I go back, I train with him. And yeah, like I said, we've even been on trips together, not specifically in Norway, but yeah, training camps and stuff. So and then sorry, your other question, remind me, was, oh yeah, like how does it work now with Hugo? So while I was out there, I basically fully embraced their training methods. So I was like, right, whatever you guys do, I'm a pretty malleable guy when it comes to running. Like I'm happy to, when I was in Kenya, I wanted to train the Kenyan way. When I was in Norway, I wanted to train their way. And when I'm running with the guys here, I'm happy to do their program kind of thing. You know, like to me, it's all good quality running and it's, yeah, you know, I'm happy to adapt and see how it goes. So I fully did the like Norwegian method. And Mitch, do you want me to maybe like just do like a typical week or something?
Yeah,
Like,
that'd be interesting, actually.
so for the guys who I was training with, at least, maybe it's like some slight variation across the board, but for them, it was so Monday, usually two easy runs. 12K in the morning, 10 or 12K in the evening. And then Tuesday was the first double threshold day of the week. So they would do something like around 30 minutes worth of threshold work. So for me at the time, it was I was doing 4 times 2K in the morning. They were doing a little bit longer, something like either 5 times 2K or sometimes like 10 minutes, 8 minutes, 6 minutes, something like that. Threshold, basic threshold work. I think 5 times 2K is like the standard. And then in the evening, it was 10 times 1K threshold. And when I say threshold, I mean it's faster than what we would define as threshold pace because you're having rest periods. You're like you're doing 10 times a K with a minute between each K. So you can run faster than what a lab result would say, hey, this is your threshold pace. But because of the rest period, your lactate levels never actually go above what's defined as your lactate threshold. So there at that time I was never measuring my lactate because I didn't have the kit, but they were measuring making sure they didn't go above threshold. So for them it was mostly around pretty much around the 3 minute mark. They could do 1K reps at 3 minutes per K with a minute recovery, and they wouldn't go above around 3 millimoles in lactate. Wednesday back to 2 easy runs. Thursday double threshold again, so Thursday would be 4 or 5 times 2K in the morning, and then 20 to 25 times 400 in the evening with 30 seconds recovery. And again, same principle. You can run a little bit faster because you're doing 400 meter reps with recoveries between each one, but running at just the right intensity that you don't go above that threshold limit. Friday back to easy, and Friday we would always take it super easy. Sometimes just 1 easy run, and it would be like slower than the rest of the runs in the week. And then Saturday would be usually the one session of the week where you're allowed to go like a bit above threshold. So we'd normally do something like 20 times 200 meter hill reps. And they were measuring lactate on those days, but just to kind of, I guess, to make sure it was controlled, but it wasn't as controlled as threshold. So in terms of numbers, and again, these numbers are like different for every individual, so don't, it's not written in stone, but they were going up to like around between 7 and 10 millimoles in lactate, so definitely above threshold, but not crazy,
How often
Sunday,
were oh yes, sorry, you oh I was just gonna ask, like, how often were they measuring their blood lactate, like, with some of these sessions?
Simon measures a lot.
Oh,
He
really?
like I Personally, I think he measures a little bit too much. Like he's a bit, I don't know, a bit obsessed, but he's an obsessive kind of guy. But he'll measure at least 2 or 3 times per workout. Not easy runs. Like that doesn't matter. Easy runs, easy runs. But yeah, in the workouts, twice, maybe 3 times. And these days, I think he's actually doing it a little bit more. He likes to get it perfect. And when I was training with him recently in Sierra Nevada, he was measuring after every rep, every interval in the 2K reps, and every like 4 or 5 in the 400 meter reps, which I thought was a bit much. Because for me, like now knowing like a bit more about it, and I've read a lot about it, and obviously spoken with those guys, and for me, there are two reasons you measure your lactate in a workout. One is during the workout to get an understanding of where you are in that moment, whether you need to whether you can allow yourself to speed up a little bit or whether you need to ease off the pace. It tells you something about that moment. So for example, let's say I'm doing 10 times 1K with a minute recovery and I want to keep it at threshold effort. I would measure after 6 reps. And if my lactate was 2.0, which is quite low, I would say, oh, hey, I can actually increase the pace a little bit here for the last 4 reps, maybe. Not crazy, but I can afford to do that. Or if I measured 4.0, I'll be like, hey, that's a little bit too much. I've still got 4 reps to go. I need to just ease back slightly, So it tells you something about the session. And I also measure once at the end of the session, so I know what the kind of like overall intensity was. And it also gives me a measure of if I'm improving, right? Because there are two ways of improving. One is, can I run faster? That's the basic way. But also, can I run the same speed at an easier intensity? So let's say in November I did 10 times 1K in 3 minutes, for example. I'm a bit slower than that, but let's say, just for easy maths, 10 times 1K in 3 minutes, and I measured 4.0 in lactate, and now I do 10 times 1K in 3 minutes, but I measure 3.5, then technically I've improved, right? Because it's easier for me to run the same pace, and it's a very measurable, measuring lactate gives you a very definite measure of that, you know, of effort.
Yes.
So that's why we were doing it. And where did I get to on the program? Sunday, just easy long run. Yeah. Around between 20, 25 K.
Yeah.
Typically. So yeah, mileage pretty high. So if you add that all up, it comes to around, for me, it was about, 160 to 170 K, 100 miles per week. With sometimes having an easier week where we'd do a little bit less, and sometimes a harder period where I'd do a little bit more even. But yeah, that's the basic program. And then with my coach now, with Hugo, to be honest, I would actually say it's a little bit of a learning curve for him as well. And I think he won't mind me saying that. Like, he's never really had experience with that method, and, you know, in the same way that I haven't. So we used Simon as a bit of a resource, to be honest. I call him quite a lot and talk to him. So Simon is actually coached by Marius Buchan, who is kind of like dubbed as the person who invented the double threshold method. You know what I mean? Like, he kind of did a lot of it. And then I think he worked with the Ingebrigtsens quite a lot and stuff. So Simon's quite a good source of knowledge for this kind of thing. And Hugo embraces that, to be honest. He gets that he isn't the fountain of knowledge with this specific type of training, which I also respect. You know, like, he's very open with me and says, hey, what do you think about this? What would Simon do? Or, like, you know, but he still gives his input. He still knows, like, when I report back to him saying, oh, I'm actually feeling pretty tired today, what would you recommend tomorrow? He knows what to say, and he knows how to adjust the program. But he also knows his limitations in terms of knowledge of this specific type of program. But I think we're also both very aware that just because this type of program has worked for a few notable people, you know, like Ingebrigtsens, for example, who are doing especially well, it doesn't mean it's the be all and end all. Mm-hmm. You know, there are plenty of other programs that work for other people that aren't double threshold.
Yep.
Josh Kerr doing double thresholds. Jake Whiteman isn't doing double threshold, and two people who beat the double thresholder, you know? So
yes,
like, it's not the only way of training. And I think it's still, even though it's a good way of training, I think it's worth experimenting still.
Yes. You know? Since COVID kind of constrained you to, like, you know, really sort of dive into it, and then you've ran that 14:05 5K PB, and you felt like that was sort of like your second really big jump in your running. What do you think were some of the things that really worked for you? Why do you reckon it helped you during that period?
So I think I'm gonna be like, I have to be like a bit honest with myself here as well. I think the reason I improved at the 5K so much was because for most of my training time throughout my whole life, I'd always been quite a speed focused guy, even though my natural speed wasn't very good. Just the training sessions I did at the club and as a kid were all short, fast sessions. So my 1500 was already quite kind of at my ceiling, if you know what I mean. I got to running like 3:48, and that's about as good as I am. You know, I've ran 3:46, and I've been running 3:46 for the last 5 years. So I feel like I've reached somewhat of a ceiling limit in the 1500, but I didn't reach that in the 5K. So then when I translated to doing a lot more like endurance specific training, suddenly my 5K took a bit of a jump. I don't think it took the jump because I necessarily did Norwegian training. I think if I did any aerobic-based endurance-focused training program, even if it was a Kenyan program or a British marathon program, I think my 5K would have improved. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
Like I
I
just
know.
hadn't done much specific endurance work, and then suddenly I did. So of course the 5K is going to improve a bit. My 1500 did also improve. That season I went from 3:48 to 3:46. But then you have to ask the question, well, why haven't you improved since then? You know, that was 2 years ago, and I've been training for 2 years, and I've still only ran 14:05. And this is something I've thought about quite a lot. And I actually think the other thing with the Norwegian threshold system is it's really easy to overdo. Like, because the volume's so high, and because you're doing two workouts per day, there's a very fine line between doing high quality threshold work and doing way too much. And that's part of the reason I did invest in a lactate monitor and start doing it more seriously and testing lactate. And that really took me by surprise because for a while, what I thought was controlled, like for me, controlled meant I'm not all out on the floor dying at the end of a session. I'm able to stand up and do a cool down, you know? But then when I was doing that thinking like, hey, this is controlled. I was measuring my lactate and it was like 8.5, which is way above threshold. So then if you do that once or twice, that's okay, you get away with it. But imagine doing that on Tuesday morning, Tuesday evening, Thursday morning, Thursday evening, multiple weeks in a row. It's unsustainable. And I think I did that way too much. That's why I stopped improving because I was just working way too hard. So I'm quite looking forward to some results this season because this is the first season I feel like I've actually done the true Norwegian threshold system where I've actually been training at threshold, keeping the lactate levels at the right level. And I've been able to, maintain that for quite some months now. So yeah, I'm interested to see if that results in any significant improvements or not.
So Callum, have you had quite a few sessions where you've checked the blood lactate monitor and just canned the session and stopped, or like slow, like kind of because it takes a little bit to sort of leave the ego at the door a little bit and just slow down and run a bit slower just to finish off the session. Have you done that a bit, in the last 6 months?
100%. Yeah, I've not. I wouldn't say I ever stop, but I've definitely. Yeah, most sessions I measure and I'm like, okay, I've got to slow down a little bit. When you're in, you know, when you're in shape, because when you measure, it's a bit lower than you're expected, and you're like, hey, I can actually pick it up a little bit now. But yeah, I would say, well, the lactate monitor is good for two reasons. I would say, firstly, I know my body a lot better as a result of using it. It's anyone who says you can run threshold sessions, true threshold sessions to feel, unless you've measured your lactate, I don't believe that you can. You can't, because what happened is after a while of me running to feel and then measuring, running to feel, measuring, running to feel, measuring, what you get is a much better understanding of what you're feeling actually correlates to. Because without that measurement, you only have the feeling and you don't know truly what the feeling correlates to. You could be running way above threshold effort and just be comfortable in that state, if you know what I mean. You can be comfortable with that pain,
Yeah,
but
you
that
get
doesn't
used
mean
to what you're
to me
used
it's,
to.
yeah, exactly. Until you actually take a measurement, you don't really know. So now I'm at the stage where now I could probably tell you within 0.5 what my lactate levels are at any given time during a session because I know, because I've measured it so much that I know what my feeling corresponds to in reality. Whereas before measuring any lactate, I couldn't have told you that. I could only tell you, yeah, this feels good or this doesn't feel good. And that doesn't actually give you that much information.
Yes.
But yeah, no, to answer your question more precisely, like, yes is the answer. I measure most threshold sessions. Sometimes I only measure at the end. And like now I feel like I'm quite good at my morning threshold sessions where they're meant to be very controlled. So I normally only measure them at the end. And if it is a little bit too high, all I say to myself is, all right, next time, just go a little bit easier. Or if it's a bit too low, then hey, next time I can afford to go a bit faster. But I don't bother measuring in the middle and adjusting because I'm good enough at them now that I know what's going on. Whereas the evening sessions, yeah, I normally measure around halfway through, make an adjustment if necessary, and then measure again at the end.
So
Yeah.
what races have you got coming up? Because you're just going into your track season, aren't you? So it'd be interesting to see how you go.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. My first race of the season is a race called Comeback 5K, which is a track race in Battersea Park in London, which has got quite a good field. I'm a guy, I take a few races to get into the hurt locker a little bit. And
Yep.
again, that's also something I've really found with the Norwegian threshold system is, because you spend such a big percentage of the year training at such a controlled intensity, you miss that little bit of hurt in your training. So when you come to the first race of the season, it's a real shock in my experience. You feel fit, but the pain really gets you
Yep.
even more so than normal, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Because like in my previous training, before I knew anything about the Norwegian threshold system, most weeks I would do a really hard workout at least once, you know, one session per week where I'm like close to all out. Like, is that correct? I don't know, but it did mean that when I came to a race, I knew how to hurt, like I knew
Yeah.
how to push myself. But doing this type of training, you definitely miss that a little bit. So I feel like I take a good three or four races to reestablish that willingness to hurt myself. But that's actually kind of another part of the training is that I think, so I was at a training camp with a guy called Narve Nordas who came third at the World Championships 1500 meters last summer. And he said like a big part of his training is the racing. So like what he'll do is coming into the track season is he'll start racing fairly early and use those races as like a training stimulus. And partly the reason for that is because in a race you have all that extra like a bit of adrenaline, you've got the crowd, you've got like the extended warm-up and everything, and it does allow you to push harder and dig deeper than you would in training. So he's essentially said he maintains that threshold system all the way through, but then he'll swap a weekend workout for a weekend race, and he finds that after three, four, five races he's suddenly in good shape without actually having to do any hard training sessions because he's just done threshold workouts with races sprinkled in
Yep.
as an extra stimulus.
So does
So I'm
he
going to try that.
that would have been an amazing experience actually, training with Nav Nordis, like over, did you say it was Sierra Nevada?
Yeah,
What,
exactly.
yeah.
It's kind of by accident. And again, this is classic Simon Hallahaugen. So he just rang me one day and invited me on a training camp. He was like, "Yeah, we're gonna go training in Sierra Nevada." I was like, "Yeah, fine, sign me up." Booked my work holiday and everything. But it turned out that I didn't know this, but to stay in the actual Sierra Nevada training facility, you have to be there with an athletics federation, like with a country federation. You can't just, you couldn't, you, I couldn't just book a place as Callum Jones. Hey, I want to book and stay here. They'd be like, no, who are you coming with? It has to be with British Athletics. And I'd be like, oh, it's not, sorry. And they'd be like, you can't stay here then. So a couple of weeks before I'm about to head out, I'm thinking like me and Seaman are just going on a jolly, a bit of training, you know, have a bit of fun in Sierra Nevada or whatever. Turns out he's actually managed to like get me into the Norwegian Athletics Federation and I'm traveling with the Norwegian Athletics team.
Oh, wow.
So I'm getting emails from like Norway Athletics saying, hey, like we've booked your training, like this is your timetable for the treadmills and the workout areas and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, cool. Who are you? Kind of thing. Like, and I get there and I'm like, yeah, I'm there with Caroline Grovdahl and Nordas and Henrik Ingebrigtsen was there. And yeah, obviously Simon's just like, oh yeah, sorry, by the way, I had to like book you with Norwegian Athletics, so you're one of us now. And I was like, Cool. I felt like I did really feel a bit awkward when I first got there because I was like, yeah, sorry guys, I'm with you. And they're like, oh, who's this British guy who's just turned up at our training camp? I'm speaking with Henry. I was speaking with Henrik at lunch, and he's like, oh yeah, so like what sort of times have you ran then? And I'm like, 3:46, sorry. And he's like, oh okay, yeah, cool. And I'm like, yeah, sorry, I'm not even that good. But it was, they were all super nice, and it was good fun. Yeah, I feel like I made quite good friends with Narva, especially. He was, yeah, super nice guy. And we did a lot of our like easy runs together and stuff, and even we could even do our workouts together because we're on treadmills that are next to each other, so it doesn't
No.
matter that he's running like a minute per kilometer faster than me.
Yeah.
We could still train together, so yeah, it was good experience, yeah, for sure. And he was just knowledgeable, good guy to speak to. He's coached by Jaap Ingebrigtsen, so he was like, yeah, a good source of truth.
Yeah. And so, will you branch away from the Norwegian double threshold method, or will you sort of try to race yourself into form, or will you do like a mixture of some faster sort of training that you've done before, like over the next few months? Yeah, like what are you thinking?
I think that works for me, adding in some faster stuff. I think for me personally, all that the Norwegian threshold system highlighted was my lack of threshold, like my lack of aerobic strength. Just yeah, like I said, because I spent so many years training without much threshold training and without much aerobic base, when I did start doing a lot of it, I did improve quite suddenly because I built up that base to such a strong level. But now, yeah, I feel like I do still need that extra stimulus, like especially for like 1500 and 5K. I'm just someone who just I just need that faster stuff to get me going, really. And I also enjoy it, I'm not competing on the world stage. I still have to admit to myself that most of the reason I run is for fun and enjoyment, and I like doing all about 300 meter reps at the track. So, I'm still gonna go and do that sometimes. So yeah, probably mix it up a bit.
That's a like I've definitely like I'm gonna definitely bring in a little bit of the double threshold method stuff in a diluted way with some of the boys I coach down in Australia. And that's why it was really good to talk to you and talk to a few other people like about the method, but I have thought about that. Like, I feel like it's very clinical and repetitive, and there's a lack of variety, which that lack of novelty and can sometimes probably sap the enjoyment away from the sport a little bit. I've thought about that a little bit just because it is so measured and repetitive to an extent.
When I was training in Norway with the group, it didn't have that feeling because you're still training with the group. And like when you're running with like friends, it doesn't matter if you're doing 1K reps or 600 reps or 800 reps. You're still going to a track and doing reps. Do you know what I mean? Like the running itself doesn't make that much of a difference, I would say. Like the workout itself, like when you've got a group, I don't feel like that took enjoyment away from it. For me personally, it's
Nice.
more that like if someone said to me, hey, you're never going to the track and doing speed work ever again, I'll be like, oh, that's kind of a shame. Like I want to sprinkle it in there. I want to do it occasionally, but I wouldn't say doing 400, 20 times 400 and 10 times 1K week in, week out is unenjoyable for me. Like now that I've said it, it kind of sounds unenjoyable, but it's not.
No, that's good to hear, actually. I'm wary of the time, Callum. Like, it's pretty late where you are. Like, I think 10:40 at night.
Nice. Yes, I don't mind. Carry on. It's you're cool. You decide when the podcast is over.
I did just want to like just ask you a bit more about Simon and how he's going now, like, because I sort of I listened to the podcast you did with him, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I'd recommend it to a lot of listeners here in Australia to listen to it, because it's really good to hear from the Norwegians who are actually doing that training method. Yeah, how's he going now? Because I think the last podcast he was a bit tired, and he was having a few troubles injury wise. Yeah, how's he going now, and how's he working through things?
If you'd asked me that exact question a month ago, the answer would have been very, very good. But okay. He recently just got a stress fracture. I think that was part of the issue. So like we've just discussed, you know your fitness very well by doing this method, because you're literally testing how hard each session is for you. And he got to the stage where he was running 1K reps. I think, I can't remember the exact time he told me, but he was running 1K reps in around 245 at threshold effort. So he was measuring like sub 3 millimoles in lactate, running 245 per K, and like 65 seconds in the 400, 20, 25 times 400 session with 30 seconds rest, measuring sub 3 millimoles in lactate. So that he was the fittest he'd ever been, and he reckoned he was going to run like 13:20 or something.
Wow.
But the difficulty with that, and how he described it to me, is when you get that fit, the lactate monitor is telling you that you can keep increasing the pace because you're not hitting threshold yet, so you can run faster next session, you can run faster next session, you can run faster. But there's also a biomechanical limit.
Yep.
Like his aerobic system and his lactate system was so good that his theory is that he outrun his own body, basically.
Yep.
He was putting so much stress through his tendons and ligaments and bones and muscles that eventually this stress fracture was inevitable, because he was just putting so much impact through his body. I feel sorry for him, because he was in a very good place, and now very suddenly he's not.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. The good news is that even though he's in this position right now, he still got to that point where he was fitter than he'd ever been and running those times. So hopefully it's only a matter of time recovering from this stress fracture and getting back into it, and then hopefully he can get back to that place again. But he certainly won't race in the first half of the summer, but he said he's got his eye on a couple of maybe some road races in the end of summer going into autumn kind of time. If he can get fit, then he'll still race this year. But he's had a really up and down couple of years, to be honest, because he's done that a couple of times. He gets really fit and then gets injured. And I think because he ran so well a couple of seasons ago, when he ran 13:37 and he was on quite an upward trajectory, think he's a bit reluctant to race until he gets back into that shape again. He's not the kind of guy, he doesn't want to go and run a 14:20. He just won't do that. I don't think we'll see him race until he's back in 13:30 shape, unfortunately, which could be could be this year, or it could be never. He's good, and we're already planning our next training camp, so fingers crossed he'll be in shape by then.
Will you be part of the Norwegian Athletics Federation again?
This one I've stipulated that it's just a friendly training camp with me. So he's got so in Norway, having a cabin is quite a normal thing, when in here in the UK, if you say, oh yeah, my friend's got a cabin, they're like, oh wow, is he super rich? But Norway, quite a lot of people have a cabin in the mountains to go away to. So he's got a cabin in the mountains, and he's kitted it out with a Woodway treadmill and stuff like that. So he's treating that as his training camp. So we're just going to go there for a couple of weeks and just do some training and chilling.
Did they do a lot on the treadmill? Because you mentioned with the Sierra Nevada training camp, there was treadmills there, and you were on the treadmill next to Nordis. They enjoy the treadmill.
Partly by necessity, right?
Yeah.
Because it's from October to April, it's like sub-zero
Yep.
and snowy and yeah, not great for running outside. I think if you spoke to most Norwegians, they would rather not do as much on the treadmill as they do, if you know what I mean. Like they would
Yep.
rather have the opportunity to go outside more often. But I think they would still choose to do quite a decent chunk of training on the treadmill because the part of their reasoning is that it's more controlled. You can more easily, you know. So if I, for example, for me, I always do my 2K reps. I've got a really nice route here next to my house, which is on a cycle path. It's completely flat and I've measured it out accurately so I know what I'm running. But even then, like even if I'm having a really good day, my pace judgment will be out by 2 or 3 seconds, you know. So if I measure my lactate and it's a little bit too high and I want to slow down by 2 seconds per 2K, that's pretty hard to judge, right? Whereas on the treadmill, you can just say, oh, okay, my lactate was a little bit too high. I'm going to go 0.1 down. And you can just do that. And it's super easy to do. So, yeah, control and like the fine tweaking ability is part of the reason. And the other part of the reason is that there's 2 foot of snow outside.
No, that's makes sense. And then just one last one because I want to let you go. And you've been so generous with your time, but like from that Norwegian training camp in Sierra Nevada, what were like some of your key takeaways from say Henrik Ingebrigtsen or Nav, like in terms of were there anything that sort of sticks with you that like was really insightful like from that experience in terms of learning about their training method or that caught you by surprise or that you sort of still have it stuck with you, I guess, today?
The number one thing I learned in that specific moment was, I've kind of already spoken about it in this podcast, was that it really is controlled. Like it's hard to describe to someone who hasn't like attempted this training method for a long period of time and like properly measured lactate levels and stuff like that, but it's more controlled than most people think. And like it really struck me when I saw Nava run 329. Yeah, 329 in the summer. Did he run even far? Did he run 328 point something? Or was it 320? No, 329. But either way, he ran freaking fast summer. And I didn't like when I was training with him the whole time, I was with him for over 3 weeks. And like he barely went below 3 minutes per K, you know, like the whole time. And like he's just super controlled, super comfortable. On the hill reps on Saturday, he pushed it a little bit hard, but like I could have kept up with him comfortably in those hill reps, and I'm 16, 17 seconds slower than him in a 1500 meters. You know, I shouldn't be able to keep up with him, but I could, not because I was really good, but because he was so controlled. Same with Henrik, same with Simon. Like they were all, yeah, just much more controlled than I even thought was the definition of the training method. What other things would I say my key takeaway? They all eat loads. Like that was a pretty cool thing. Like I thought, oh, maybe, you know, this whole routine is super strict and everyone's like measuring and it's very scientific. And then they go to the canteen and they just pile their plates up with everything and just, yeah, devour like, yeah, whatever they want, basically get the calories in. That was pretty cool. Yeah, that's probably, yeah, the controlledness was my number one takeaway and that I needed to implement more in my own training. And I would say like it's you can get away with not being controlled once or twice, but if you keep letting it slip, then you're no longer doing Norwegian training method. You're just training hard multiple times per day, and then it doesn't work because the whole point of this method is the fact that it allows you to do a very high volume of threshold training very consistently for a very large period of the year. And as soon as you go above that all breaks down. So it's better to be on the side of being a little bit too controlled than being a little bit too hard. And they're all I think that's potentially another, going back to the treadmill question, potentially another reason why they train on the treadmill a lot is if you train together, you can't guarantee you're at your threshold pace.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm at the track with another person who's a little bit faster than me and I try and train with them, well, I'm not doing my threshold system anymore. I'm doing their threshold, which might be different to mine. And yeah, okay, it might be just a touch over threshold. You might not even notice it. But if I do that week in, week out, then the training method is done. It's wrong. Whereas if you run on the treadmill, you can still run kind of as a group together or whatever, or not if you don't want to, but you're at your specific pace. And I think, and that's the most important thing to them.
Yes.
Is that they're training at their right intensity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, yeah. So cool. Like that makes heaps of sense. And that means that intensity control is going to be even better. But then you still get that group training. Do you think, and I guess that intensity control is so important because then that allows you to do that greater volume of work to get that different stimulus, that variable, that change in stimulus. Cause that's what I'm excited to try out with a few of the boys I coached that I've coached them for 5 years and they've done the same kind of training for a long time. I feel like they're quite resilient now and they're at the stage of maturity where they need something a bit different. And so they like the idea of like, instead of doing three sessions a week, I'm going to do every couple of weeks, we're going to do two. And, you know, one of them might be just a bit bigger with this kind of like, model in mind, like we're doing, like a little bit more volume, at threshold. And it's something they haven't done before. So obviously it's a new stimulus. There's a bit of risk involved, but at the same time, I'm trying to be calculated about it. But so sure. The intensity control is going to be really important. But I think that's also where I'm hoping the benefit could be because they're just doing a little bit more work than they have done in the past. Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, those morning threshold sessions especially, like another guy I've learned a lot from who I've not said much is about is a, yeah, I would consider him a friend of mine now as well. He's a friend of Siemens, but I know him fairly well now. A guy called Ferdinand, who's also ran, I think he ran like 3:35, maybe slightly faster, 3:34 maybe. I might have just insulted him now. I'm going to have to look this up in a second. Faster than 3:35, I think. I had a very interesting conversation with him last time I was in Norway about specifically about the morning threshold sessions. And he said for him and for most people, they should be sub threshold, not even at threshold. So for him, he wants to be measuring like sub 2 millimoles in lactate just to show that you're working sub threshold, right? And the reason for that is, I mean, you probably know more about this than me, but when you're building like a really strong aerobic base, partly what's happening is, you know, you have these, well, type one muscle fibers and type two muscle fibers, and type one, the more slow twitch muscle fibers are actually very good at recycling, reusing lactate, right? So the better you build up that system, the stronger those type one muscle fibers are becoming. They're actually becoming more suited to removing lactate from the system. So your lactate threshold actually improves even when you're working sub threshold because you're working on the muscle fibers that are removing lactate. So that's almost like it's almost like increasing the size of the bucket that where you can withstand high levels of lactate because they can shuttle it faster.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Yes, now those morning sessions, like it actually feels after a morning threshold session, 4 or 5 times 2K. So for me, my pace is around about somewhere between 3:15 and 3:20 per K, which is like, I would say it's probably slower than half marathon pace for me.
Yeah.
I would come back from that session feeling not much different to after an easy run. You know, I've just come back and I feel, yeah, fine, go take a shower and then I can sit down and do a bit of work and feel just fine, you know? I don't feel like I've done a workout at all. Maybe I'm a little bit hungrier or something, but just, yeah, you feel fine. The evening sessions are slightly harder, but still, you don't... I'm kind of comparing it to when I was 16 years old and I'd come back from every session and I would have to like lie on the sofa and just like pass out basically,
yeah.
You know, but it is a different feeling for sure. And like you said, the whole reason behind it is so that you can do more.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's like extensify rather than intensify. And the thing with training down here is like coming off track season, like, we were constantly kind of trying to make training more and more specific. So we were doing so much, like a lot of specific sort of training at 5K pace or 5K effort. It's going to be fun to play around with and a good experiment. Callum, like, I couldn't be more grateful for this chat. And
no worries.
Like, yeah, thanks so much for your time. I'm sure you want to go to sleep. just quickly, like, for listeners that have really enjoyed this chat and want to find out more about you, running trips, or your coaching service, Train Smarter, Run Faster, where can they find out more?
Yeah, so Running Trips, we've got a website, runningtrips.co.uk, or specifically the training camps in Kenya is traininkenya.com. Nice and easy.
Yeah.
Or running_trips_official on Instagram. That's probably the main one where I'm posting daily and stuff, but that's more of like our business account. And then me personally, I'm just runner.cal.
Yep.
Pretty lame. that's my Instagram. Pretty much it. Well, feel free to follow or whatever, but
yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, thanks,
Chatting about
running. Yeah, exactly. Conversations about running.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Nice. But yeah, thanks for that, mate.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot.